Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. As you know, at Socrates in the City, we have had all kinds of guests on all kinds of subjects. You can go to our website, socratesinthecity.com. Twice, as my guest at Socrates in the City, I had my friend Stephen Meyer, who has written many books and has a new book out now called The Return of the God Hypothesis. I have read it. I am very, very excited about it. In fact, it's not even out yet officially, but I don't care. You can pre-order it. And I get to talk to my friend Stephen Meyer about it right now. Dr. Stephen Meyer, welcome to this program.
Thanks for having me, Eric. It's always great to talk to you.
Look, your book is so exciting, but I guess I need to talk about you a little bit, or you need to talk about you or talk to me about you. Who are you? You're with the Discovery Institute. You've written a lot of books, Signature in the Cell. You're a leading figure in the ID movement. For folks who don't know who you are, give us a little bit of a background.
Right. I went to grad school in the philosophy of science, having been trained as a scientist. I was initially worked as a geophysicist and then went to grad school and I got seized with the importance of the issue of the origin of life. I attended a conference in the early years of my career as a scientist where scientists were debating different theories about the origin of the universe, the origin of life from both a theistic and an atheistic or materialistic perspective. And I learned that there was this huge impasse in attempts to explain where life came from, that Darwin never really addressed that, the question of the origin of the first life. He tried to explain where new life came from pre-existing life. But getting from the chemicals in the prebiotic soup to the first living cell was a completely unsolved mystery. And the thing that seized me about it was the reason for the mystery. And that was that at the foundation of life, there was code or information in the DNA molecule. And it was very hard to explain how simple chemical reactions could create a complex code. And I'd been working in an early form of information technology in my job in geophysics. And I got fascinated with this question, went off to grad school to Cambridge, England, and spent 4 years there investigating it more and started meeting a lot of other scientists who had similar questions, not only about what was called chemical evolution, but also about Darwinian evolution, the standard theory that we all learn about how life started from a simple cell and became much more complex and diversified over time. And so eventually a number of us kind of started to congeal into something like a research community or a movement. And we started a program at the Discovery Institute. We now have a worldwide network of scientists who are skeptical about standard materialistic explanations and evolutionary theories about the origins and development of life. And that's expanded still further into folks that are interested in questions of cosmology and the origin of the universe, other questions that challenge a materialistic worldview, like our understanding of our own consciousness and the mind-body question. So at Discovery, we're interested in these big questions that are at the intersection between science and philosophy, or science and worldview, if you will. And we're mainly challenging the standard materialistic perspective that everything came from molecules or energy in a soup, and that all that's been here forever and there's no need for a designer or creator.
Well, let's go back to that, because I have gotten fascinated in all this stuff in large part thanks to you and to Dr. James Tour, whom you know. Before we get into that, though, your book, when is your book coming out officially, The Return of the God Hypothesis?
It's out March 30th. And will be available for purchase online then. I think we'll have physical copies a couple of weeks before then. And it's all finished. I've actually been working on it for 3.5 years in the formal period of writing, but thinking about it since that very first conference that I mentioned way back now, for me, 35 years.
Was that in 85 or 86?
It was 1985, right. I was a very young scientist.
When in 85? Because this was in Dallas, right?
February, right, of 85.
Okay, so way back. You write about it in your book. I mean, I've read your book, and I don't know if I've given you an endorsement for it yet. I need to do that because I read the book more than once.
Well, you just did. Thank you.
No. It's really, you know, it's not just a good book. It's very important. It's extremely important because you bring together some of the most important recent thinking on the biggest issue of modern times, one of the biggest issues of modern times. And I think that, you know, you say the return of the God hypothesis. In other words, you're suggesting that science is leading us to take infinitely more seriously than we did a few decades ago the idea that the answer to some of these conundrums is God, that you can't talk about life emerging out of non-life. Now, I mean, most people don't ever think about this. Like we talk about evolution, forget evolution. Evolution is when you have life and then you say, what happens to that life? How does it evolve? How does it emerge? How does it develop into these other life forms? That's another subject. You talk about everything in your book, but one of the key things is this idea of abiogenesis, the idea that there once was a time on Earth when there was zero life, and then suddenly there's life. And when we talk about primitive life, we now know, and I only know this thanks to you, the complexity of the simplest life is mind-numbing. No one who really understands how complex it is could ever dream that it just happened. I mean, it's just scary. So let me ask you this question. At what point, Stephen, did we have a clue of the complexity of this white life? In other words, in 1952, when Miller Urey did their famous experiment that was in every textbook, that they, you know, put some stuff in some saline solution, they shot it with electricity and some stuff came out. What came out of that? Amino acids?
A few of the protein forming amino acids. They sparked some gases.
So in the amino discharge acids came out of this. And I remember it's like, that's that. We now know how life began, which is of course nonsense because amino acids are not life. They're not even close to life, but they thought, hey, we'll figure it out. That was 70 years ago. We figured out nothing. But my question is, at what point did we recognize the tremendous complexity of the simplest life? What did Miller Urey know about?
Well, the irony is that it happened almost simultaneously with that experiment, that in 1953, Watson and Crick first published their paper elucidating the structure of the DNA molecule. About the same time, other scientists were figuring out how complex proteins were. And then later they realized that there was a connection. Crick in 1958 proposed what he called the sequence hypothesis. And that was the idea that along the spine of the twisting helix of the DNA, there were chemical subunits, they're known as bases or nucleotide bases, that are literally functioning like alphabetic characters in a written language, or we'd now say digital characters like the zeros and ones in a section of software, which is to say that they didn't perform a function by virtue of their chemical properties or their weight or their shape or something like that, but rather in virtue of their arrangement in accord with a code that was later discovered and is now known as the genetic code. So you had genetic text, you had information in a text that was being interpreted by a code that was being used to construct the proteins and protein machines that keep cells alive. So they discovered something like our modern CAD/CAM technology, where you have called computer-assisted design and engineering, where you have digital information literally producing mechanical parts in a factory. And this is what's going on at the foundation of the cell. And by about the mid-60s, this had all become clear. So in that stretch from about 1953 to about 1965, historians of science now call that the molecular biological revolution.
Okay, hold on. We're going to go to a break because this is just big stuff, important stuff, but everybody can understand enough of it. And that's why I want to talk about it. We'll be right back. Folks, I'm talking to Stephen Meyer, Dr. Stephen Meyer. He has a new book coming out, The Return of the God Hypothesis. This is going to be a blockbuster. Stephen, what are some of your previous books? Signature in the Cell.
And Darwin's Doubt. And in both those two books, I argued for the case for intelligent design, that there was evidence of an intelligent designer of some kind based on this informational technology at the foundation of life. Bill Gates, our famous local hero out here in Seattle, has said that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever created. We know that software comes from a programmer. In fact, we know that whenever we find information, especially in an alphabetic or digital form, we always come to a mind, whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription or paragraph in a book, or even information embedded in a radio signal or in a computer program, information always comes from the activity of a mind. And so the discovery of information at the foundation of life by Watson and Crick and others in the 1950s and 60s has provided powerful evidence of a designing mind in the history of life. That was the argument of the first two books. And in the new book, I'm extending that argument to identify the designer.
Well, that's what's so fascinating, because as I have done my own reading on this, and part of that reading, of course, is your book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, which is going to be out soon. It strikes me as really impossible to communicate the level of complexity we're talking about. In other words, I think that when you think about a car is much less complex than a cell when we're talking about DNA. And yet nobody can imagine that a car could just come into being randomly. So what are scientists saying these days who don't like the idea of God, who don't like the idea of an intelligent designer? Where are they with this? Because I cannot help but think, when you look at a cell with the technology we now have to look at a cell, this is not just some protoplasm and some membrane. I mean, we can really see what's going on. What do they make of the complexity in there that this could maybe just have randomly popped into being?
Well, in fact, many scientists are coming to the position of intelligent design. They're affirming that there must have been a designing agent of some kind involved. But others, perhaps still the mainstream view, is we'll figure it out eventually. And that if people reject the argument for intelligent design, they usually do not do so by saying, hey, we have a better theory of how this happened. What they're now saying is, well, it's against the rules of science to consider creative intelligence as part of the explanation of what we see. So we have to stick to strictly materialistic processes, but we as yet don't know of any that could produce the type of complexity and the informational complexity that we see at the foundation of life. But we have to hold on until we find something that will solve the problem within the framework of materialistic science.
So okay, let me just interrupt and say that's garbage. In other words, what you just said, and you know this, is that when somebody says that science can only have materialistic answers, that we're stuck with materialism, that's not true. That's a philosophical position. It has nothing
Absolutely.
To do with
that. Yeah, it has a big fancy name in philosophy. It's called the principle of methodological naturalism. It means if you're going to be a scientist, you have to limit yourself to explanations involving matter and energy. You can't posit mind as part of the explanation for what you see, but we all the time posit the activity of an intelligence or mind. Imagine if you walk into the British Museum and you see the Rosetta Stone with those three different sets of inscriptions that were finally translated by the archaeologists. When they realized that they were looking at informational script, they immediately inferred that that information was the product of intelligence. They didn't say it was wind and erosion or some sort of chemicals etching the rock. They knew right away that there had been scribes. And so in our experience, information is always the province of intelligence. It's always produced by a mind. And so the discovery of information should, by our own established methods of reasoning, lead us to the conclusion that there was a mind involved. We know of only one cause of information. When we find it, we should infer that cause was, in fact, active. And that's what we're arguing when we make the case for intelligent design.
When we look at a cell, I mean, let's put DNA to the side because that's just an insane level of information. But just even putting that to the side, if with the technology that we have today to look at a cell and to see what is happening there, the simplest cell, tell my audience, for those of us who don't remember these things, and I think that's most of us, what is happening in a cell that would make me think this is very complex? What is complex? What is happening in the most basic cell?
Yeah, you have all the elements of a modern information transmission system. You've got a storage system. You have a way of translating the information. You have a way, the information is then used to construct something. And we have an animation on my website called Journey Inside the Cell that actually shows exactly how this works, how the information.
What is the DNA, website? What is that website?
There's a new author website called StephenCMeyer.com, and you can go from there, navigate from there to all the books, including the new book, Return of the God Hypothesis.
Stephen is PH, right?
Yes,
Stephen
right.
C. Meyer, MEYER.com. StephenCMeyer.com right. is the website. I want people to go there because I want them to look at this. But before you go farther, we're talking about a basic cell, the most simple cell. I've learned recently, you know, what is life? Okay, so the simplest life has to be able to reproduce itself. It has to be able to maintain itself, to heal itself, right? I mean, if there's some kind of an injury, just that is amazing.
Well, there's an amazing thing. We all use spell check, right, in our computers. The cell has its own spell check. It's called automated error correction. And when there's a mutation or an error in the transmission of the information in the DNA, there are molecular machines that jump in, excise that error, and then replace the incorrect letter or letters with correct letters. So there's that level. It's not just that there's information in DNA. The information is being expressed and transmitted and used to construct things. And there's also a whole information processing system that can even correct incorrectly transmitted information. So it's
now what is that called? I'm lost. In a simple cell, what is that called? I mean, that's a level of complexity that's a little mind-boggling, frankly.
Yeah, it's a hierarchical system of information control where you've got information at one level processing the information at another to make sure that everything is transmitted correctly.
It's unbelievable. What about what are the simplest kinds of cells? When we think about the simplest life that ever came into being at the beginning, what would that be? Are we talking about, you know,
two basic types of cells that scientists talk about: prokaryotes and eukaryotes. The eukaryotes have a nucleus. They come much later. The earliest cells are the prokaryotes, no nucleus. They have circular chromosomes. That's bacteria would be examples of prokaryotic cells.
Right.
But as scientists have analyzed this, they've tried to figure out, what's the very simplest cell that could possibly exist? And so they've done what are called minimal complexity experiments. And they start knocking out genes to see how low can they go and still maintain some function. And they still get several hundred genes and proteins required. So if you talk about the origin of the first life, it's not just a matter of getting one gene or one protein. You've got to get several hundred in working in a coordinated fashion. And the idea that simple chemical reactions on the prebiotic earth could have produced such a thing is frankly laughable.
Now, when we go back to the Miller-Urey experiment, 1952, it wasn't published till 53, but the point is that was used, that was the gold standard. It was put in every textbook and it said to every young person, we have figured out how life evolved on the early Earth, here it is. And because of Dr. James Tour, I know that that's nonsense. In other words, this was just the beginning of the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. And they said, we'll figure it out as we go along. And the more time passed, the less we figured out. In other words, the more difficult the whole thing seemed. We haven't gone forward. We've really gone backwards in a way. For example, what Miller and Urey put in their probiotic soup in this experiment, we now know
It didn't match the early Earth's atmosphere, right? They were trying to simulate what the conditions would have been like on the early Earth. So they put a bunch of gases in a spark discharge chamber, but the gaseous mixture that they chose had a quality that's known as, to chemists, it was a reducing atmosphere. reducing atmosphere will cause reactions to occur spontaneously because it's energy rich. But we now know that there was a neutral or oxidizing atmosphere, and that would not cause those amino acids to form in a spontaneous way. But even if you get the amino acids, they're just the building blocks of the larger molecules called proteins that do all the important jobs in cells. The proteins are like the toolbox of the cell, the hammer, the wrench. You can think of them that way, as the molecules, the big molecules that do important jobs. And all they got were the building blocks. You have to arrange those building blocks in the correct order so that they'll fold into the right structure so that they can do a job.
Hang on a second. We have to go to these breaks. We'll be right back talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer.
Singing the same old song. I know every crack in these dirty sidewalks of Broadway.
Folks, I'm talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer. There's a new book coming out soon. I have read it. It's called The Return of the God Hypothesis. Stephen, we're talking about, you know, some deep stuff here, but it's important that we understand this, right? So let's go back again to the Miller-Urey experiment. In 1952, these ambitious scientists at the University of Chicago, this is under the Truman administration, that's how far back this is, decide that we think we know what existed before life on Earth, this prebiotic soup. Of course, prebiotic just means before life. So they assume that this planet is covered with water, whatever it is. They basically say that there are a couple of basic elements that are there, some compounds, whatever. So there's methane, there's ammonia, there's oxygen, right. There's nitrogen. They put some of these things in a flask or some kind of a glass chamber, and they shoot it through with electricity. Now, the first question is, what they had put in that chamber, their assumptions about the prebiotic Earth, were those chemicals the right chemicals? Did they get that part of it right?
No, they got that wrong. What we know from geochemistry is that the early Earth's atmosphere was not reducing. That means it would not spontaneously, because of its energy richness, produce the amino acids that they were able to produce in the laboratory. So that was just a false assumption. They were trying to simulate the early Earth, but they didn't use a gaseous mixture that matched what we now know the Earth's early atmosphere would have been like.
What would the gaseous mixture that were correct, what would that be? In other words, what sort of, or do we know?
Methane, ammonia, and a few other gases that would have collectively been what scientists call exothermic. It would have caused reactions to spontaneously occur. And
you're saying that's what they used, or no?
That's what they used, but that's not what the early Earth's atmosphere would have been like. It would have been neutral with respect to its energy properties, or slightly oxidizing, which would have quenched the important biochemical reactions that they were hoping to simulate.
So do we know what that actual mixture would have been today? Do we have an idea?
We have a pretty good idea from the kinds of minerals that we find on the rocks from that period of time. You can tell something about the atmosphere from the sorts of things that were present in the rocks.
Well, so the question is, have we tried to do these experiments with what we now know to have been correct?
Well, I suppose, but the point is that with the atmospheric conditions that would have prevailed on the early Earth, the experiments would produce nothing. So people don't really spend much time doing them.
So what do these people say who are in this field? I mean, that's...
Well, they try to simulate other aspects of the origin of life, you know, because it would be a multi-step process. So how do you get the first sugars? How do you get the first nucleotide bases? How do you get the first amino acids? Try other types of prebiotic experiments. What Jim Tour has shown is that all of these experiments, to move in a life-friendly direction, you have to use a complicated recipe where the chemist is intimately involved at every step in choosing the the reagents, the reaction products have to be removed at the right time. Things have to be heated up and cooled at a certain time. And what that's actually simulating from my point of view is intelligent design. And that was one of the points of my first book, Signature in the Cell, is that that even the attempt to simulate the origin of life in a purely naturalistic way, even these attempts are inadvertently illustrating the need for intelligent agency to move the process along.
That's what James Tour writes about. And I put some of that in the book that's coming out this fall called Is Atheism Dead? And James Tour, I always find very funny because he gets very animated about how this is preposterous. In other words, the idea that they're trying to do this, it's so complicated. And what you just said is that he says that the very reactions that would create maybe what we're looking for continue once that thing is created and immediately begin to degrade that thing. So if you want to create something, you've got to create it, keep your eyes on it, and the second it's ready, boom, take it out. Yeah. Otherwise it dies. And you kind of think, okay, how would that happen on the early Earth with nobody around? What is this process? And he makes it pretty clear that it's obvious that it didn't happen, that the people do.
The logic of these simulation experiments is that you're reproducing the conditions that you think would have brought life into existence. But when in every experiment, intelligence plays an indispensable role in moving the chemistry in a direction that's at least relevant to life, then what you're actually simulating is the need for intelligence or intelligent design. In addition, what we see in the DNA molecule should lead us to the same conclusion, because we know from our uniform and repeated experience, which is the foundation of all scientific reasoning, that whenever we see information, especially in a digital or an alphabetic form, we always know that intelligence has been involved. Intelligence is always involved in the generation of information, and that's what we have at the foundation of life.
Well, to me, a lot of our audience won't know what this is, but the term Rube Goldberg device comes to mind, right? A Rube Goldberg device, people can look it up online, but Rube Goldberg was somebody who would design these, he would do cartoons and, in the funny papers or whatever, but it was always some incredibly complex, you can see these all over YouTube. Somebody designs a thing where a ping pong ball shoots out of something, lands on something, and causes the balance to go down. And when the other side comes up, there's an electrical connection, which causes something else to happen. It goes on and on and on and on.
The dominoes all fall.
And the dominoes fall and then they hit something else. I mean, it's so complex, but really that is what we're talking about right now. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation, but it's so fascinating. Folks, don't go away. Folks, I'm talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer. You can find him at his new website. You've got to go there, stephencmeyer.com. It's PH, Stephen C. Meyer is MEYER.com. A lot of stuff there, stephencmeyer.com. So Stephen C. Meyer, I was just kind of trying to get my head around this, that when we're talking about all of these processes ending up in creating life, the only cognate that I can come up with is something like what we call a Rube Goldberg device. It's really hard
It's important Goldberg when we use device. The word complexity to realize that what we're talking about is an integrated form of complexity where every part is performing a function that is critical to the function of all the other parts. So we're not just talking about a random mess. We're talking about integrated complexity like a Rube Goldberg machine or an internal combustion engine or a system for processing digital information such as in a computer. That's the level of complexity. Except with life, the complexity is also capable, the complex system is also capable of reproducing itself, of making another complex system, which is something we've never figured out how to do. And in the living cell, it's not just the information that's building the proteins, but it's also building these exquisite protein machines. Michael Behe has made famous the bacterial flagellar motor, but there are dozens of these machines, little turbines, sliding clamps. It's an exquisite world of nanotechnology inside every living cell of every living organism. And so, the biblical phrase fearfully and wonderfully made does pop to mind.
Okay, so Michael Behe, we had him on Socrates in the City. He's been on this program. His last book is called Darwin's Doubt. And in that book, now, what is your book called?
It has that's my second book, Darwin's Doubt. He has a book called Darwin Devolves.
Darwin Devolves. I'm sorry. In Darwin Devolves, he talks about some of these things, but I guess I just want to ask you, when we're talking about this process, right? Let's say, okay, Miller-Urey creates some amino acids, right? Just help us understand, how far are we still from a cell? Let's say, okay, boom, hey, we created amino acids. What happens to those amino acids now? They have to be—
Well, the amino acids you can think of as kind of like letters that have to be arranged properly to make a sentence. Now, the sentence corresponds to what's called a polypeptide chain, which then has to fold into a three-dimensional structure that will perform a function, like processing information or catalyzing certain reactions.
Is this yet a protein?
That's a protein. Okay, so but proteins—
Well, a polypeptide chain is a protein.
If it folds properly, it becomes a protein.
If it folds properly, it becomes a protein.
Right.
Give us an example. Are we talking about origami? How complex is the
way beyond origami? Yeah. I mean, one of the most important proteins is called a polymerase. And that's essentially a molecular copying machine that is able to copy all the information on DNA. And it's massive. It's got thousands of these amino acids arranged in a very specific way so that it folds properly so that it can do this job. But there are hundreds of proteins in even the simplest living cells, all doing different jobs, all in a coordinated fashion. And then we've got the cellular organelles, we've got the membranes, which we used to think of as very, very simple, but the membranes for cells have gated channels that allow certain things through and other things not to
come. Now, what does it remind us? Because a lot of us, we don't remember our chemistry. What's an organelle?
Well, it's a specialized part of the cell that performs a specialized process, like, for example, the production of energy. So when you describe the cell as a chemical factory, you're understating it, but not far off, you know. So
right. Okay. And so you said that, I mean, this is what I'm so fascinated by, because you know this, but most of us don't know this, don't remember it if we ever knew it. You're saying that You take some things like a nitrogen, oxygen, methane, ammonia, whatever. You put them someplace. You run electricity through them. It is possible out of that you may get some amino acids. You're telling me now those amino acids—
They're the lowest level building blocks. You know, it'd be like having a couple bricks and saying you'd explain how the Empire State Building came together. You know, that's
right.
Yeah.
And actually, that it's more complex than that, but. So you're saying that the amino acids have to come together into a polypeptide chain, which is a protein. So has it been shown that these amino acids can become the proteins necessary, that they can fold, that they can begin to fold?
Not without extensive assistance from intelligent chemists. They don't link together. There's energetic impediments to linking together. There's no explanation for them linking together in the correct order or sequence. That's the information problem. And so, no, we're really, from the standpoint of simple materialistic chemistry, we're as you said before, we're further away from explaining the origin of life, not closer.
In 70 years, which is fascinating. And James Tour has basically said, we need to shut down all research funding, because it's kind of like barking up the wrong tree. You're wasting your money. You're going to have to kind of regroup and rethink it, because this is not working. Is there anybody honest about this? In other words, when you talk about the complexity of going from amino acids to polypeptide chains to, you know, this process, is there anybody honest about how preposterous it is to think that that could have happened?
Oh, many people over in time? Private are honest about this, but you know, the public presentation of theories about the origin of life continues apace. Before James Tour, there was another very prominent chemist whom I had the opportunity to meet at conferences, named Robert Shapiro. And he was known as Dr. No within the field of prebiotic chemistry, because he was always holding people's feet to the fire and saying, that's not a realistic scenario. The chemicals don't do that, or they don't do that without your assistance. So, and Tour is
taking up that mantle. Yeah. But it is funny because, again, most of us, you know, us lay people out here, we were told, no, 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 we, that was figured out long ago. And the assumption is over time, they figured out more and more and more and more. You're telling me no, but it seems like the reason they haven't advertised this information is because they'll lose funding or they don't really want to let these dirty trade secrets out.
Well, there's also an, there's also a philosophical commitment to a materialistic explanation for the origin of life and the origin of everything, the origin of the universe. And so you find similar dynamics as people start to talk about things like the multiverse rather than accepting the most obvious explanation for what physicists describe as the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics. The, so we not only have evidence of design, and this is what my new book is about, we not only have evidence of design in the simplest living cells, but we have evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe. And rather than accept that that evidence, take that evidence at face value, physicists are now inventing things like...
When we come back, we'll talk about all of that kooky stuff, talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer. I'm talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's with the Discovery Institute. The new book is coming out soon. It is called The Return of the God Hypothesis. It is a whopper of a book. I've read it. Unbelievable level of information. I just want to ask a simple question. When we're talking about the simplest cell, the simplest form of life, how does that life eat?
Well, it... absorbs nutrients from the atmosphere, or from the surrounding, usually aqueous environment in which it lives. This is a one-celled organism. If it's within a larger body, then we provide nutrients to our cells through the bloodstream. So
okay, no, forget that. I'm talking about single cell, the most simple organisms. And aren't some of these simple one-celled organisms aggressive predators? Don't they go after things? And you know, use pinocytosis, and don't they eat in that way? Or is that much more complex?
Other one-celled organisms or absorb nutrients. Remember the little bacterial flagellar motor that Behe has made famous? That's a system that actually allows one-celled organisms to track down nutrient-rich parts of the solution in which they find themselves, their aqueous solution. So,
and to propel themselves toward it.
Right. It's hardwired into what's called a signal transduction system that enables them to detect changes in the nutrient gradient. So they can zoom around and find the places that are richer in the sugars and other things they need to stay alive. It's just incredible technology it's high tech in a low form of life.
The word I keep repeating is it's preposterous to think that this could have just happened. I mean, what we're talking about, it's comical, Stephen. I mean, when you talk about something that tiny with a flagellum motor, with a tail that's whipping around to propel it forward toward parts of a solution that have more of what it's looking for, how does it know that? It's just monumental to think that something that small can detect where the food is, can propel itself toward the food. And we're saying, oh, well, this just kind of happened randomly. Just the flagellum we know couldn't have happened randomly. Are there people, I remember once about 12 years ago, I asked Francis Collins about this and he kind of sneered at the idea of the flagellum, like, oh, we've kind of figured that out. Have we figured that out?
Oh, absolutely not. There was a proposal known as co-option, the idea that maybe there was a simpler molecular system from which the flagellar later evolved, but it's now become, there's a little secretion device in the flagellum that the larger motor parts are added to and built around during its biosynthesis. But we've now learned that secretion device, where it occurs in isolation, it's called a type 3 secretory system, is actually a devolutionary byproduct of the original system. It's not the ancestor, the parts.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, but so do folks like the folks at BioLogos or whatever, do they concede this stuff?
Well, they typically will take, after I published my book, Darwin's Doubt, which is about the Cambrian explosion, the origin of all these new forms of animal life, several reviews were run of the book, and the biologists there acknowledged that this is a completely unsolved problem from the standpoint of evolutionary theory. But the philosophers who reviewed the book said, but we have to keep holding on for materialistic explanations. So the biologists, biologist people acknowledge the limitations of current evolutionary theory, but they're committed to finding purely naturalistic explanations, which they think of as God's secondary causes, but no such explanations have been forthcoming.
Right. And that's also not science. That is scientism. We don't have time to go into that.
Yeah.
Stephen, I'm just so glad we began our conversation. I want to have you back to talk about lots more, but the book, which is coming out soon, is called The Return of the God Hypothesis. Stephen C. Meyer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Eric. Great to talk.